Doug Unger took care of his brother Steve during the last stages of terminal illness. But that wasn't the first time he'd nursed a relative during the end of life, and he shared those experiences with Dave Becker.
Now, this marked the third time you've helped with this kind of a caregiving experience. The other two experiences were with your aunt and with your first wife. How were those experiences different for you?
Well, as I've been thinking about it, and I've thought about it a great deal, they were three very, very different experiences. One was with an aunt to my wife's family, so an aunt by marriage, that we was dying in, and she was a... She was a very independent-minded woman, a one-woman dairy farmer, if you can imagine that, up in Washington State. She had run her own farm with hired hands and managed her own affairs. She also wrote a weekly column for a weekly newspaper, kind of a gossip column of country matters. So she was a great thinker as well, and a very strong-willed woman. And she was diagnosed with colon cancer, and we brought her into our home for the last 6 months of her life. And that experience was the old country farmer dying experience, the death accepting experience of the old German farm culture, which is you go into the home, you face it, you say goodbye to your family, you get your affairs in order. A few funny things that I can think of. We and in that case, we had a large support system. We had the nieces, and we had me and my daughter and our whole family gathered around her. Her major requirements were that she couldn't stand the town water. She wanted us to go fill a big jug full of her well water, which she insisted on drinking and had a better
did
taste.
You?
Yes, we did.
You did.
But this was very, very non-interventionist by nursing or hospice or anything. She had a doctor and so forth, and we administered medications. If there's one thing I would do over again is that she was such a strong-willed woman that she wanted no pain medication. And at the end, she really needed it, and I wanted to impose it on her, and I lost that battle. But to this day, I regret the last week of her life. But she was just the kind of woman who wanted to experience everything the way it would naturally happen, including the pain. And she was in our house until about 16 hours before she died, and then we faced a medical emergency, a hemorrhaging situation that we were absolutely incapable of dealing with, and she was transferred to a hospital where she died 16 hours later. Mm-hmm. But that was perhaps a death-accepting experience that had a kind of holistic rightness to it, except that I wished she would have agreed to take painkillers.
Yeah. I had an uncle who went through that exact same experience, Lou Gehrig's disease, and he embraced his final hours and did not want to have a muddied head.
Right.
The same thing. No, did not want painkillers.
I think with Aunt May, her name was Mary Kay Burke. We called her Aunt May. I think that she wanted to feel the toughness of having made it through the hardest part of life, which was her dying. And she did. The other experience I had was with my first wife, and we had been separated for some time, and she had multiple medical conditions, and the reason we didn't divorce was because we could not, at that time, 2003, find any health insurance company that would take her after she would have been cobra'd, after she would have been done with the cobra part of insurance from my job. So I was in another relationship, and I stayed married to provide her health coverage. Praise be that the Affordable Care Act has taken care of that, because she could not be discriminated against for pre-existing conditions or offered a health insurance policy that would bankrupt our family. But toward the end, she was diagnosed with a cancer, a large cell cancer that had spread to her bones, her brain. It was in her lung, her liver. It was everywhere, and it was a surprise diagnosis. And she asked me if I would be the one who would come to her bedside and actually help manage her dying. And I did 5 weeks right after the diagnosis. I went up and we arranged a home care nursing service We managed the whole process of her dying. The home care nursing service worked out very, very well because they provided the equipment, the drugs. It was paid for by insurance. And they also had a kind of nursing service that was fairly reasonable that could spell me in my caregiving role. And the first week we took care of all the legal business. She had some heritage property she wished to pass to our daughter and did pass on to our daughter. The second week and third week were all about visits, seeing people she loved and knew and managing them in her home three and four a day, three at the most so she wouldn't be worn out. And then the last week and a half was the visits closed down, and it became the messy and hard part of the dying process. But I felt like there was a lot more support in that with the family, part of the family around, and with the home care nursing service than with the hospice service.
Did you feel ambivalent about this when she asked you to be the one who would help her? Did you have any second thoughts about that?
I had no second thoughts whatsoever. We had had a 20-year long marriage and relationship, and we certainly still cared for one another, loved one another.
But you knew what was coming. You know how it would end. I'm assuming your Aunt May had died before, so you had gone through this experience once.
I had it in mind what would happen, though one never knows. Every person is different. Every disease is different. And there were certain things that did happen that I was not prepared for. Sometimes before a person dies, there's a moment when that person becomes very, very physical. A dying person who's been bedridden for a week is fully capable of leaping out of a bed and dancing around a room, and then the caregiver's having to put that person back in bed. Sometimes there's a tremendous physical manifestation of energy and strength that comes out.
Where do you think that comes from?
I don't know whether it's the brain or the body flaring up one last time. Sometimes it happens in a moment of lucidity that happens just the day before a death that's written about in great literature, certainly. With many dying people, The Death of Ivan Ilyich by Leo Tolstoy has a moment that's beautifully written that's just like this. But she had some physical situations which were very, very difficult to control and required medication, required two people, and were in no way her fault, were just a part of the physical process of her dying. We did have another complication in that death, which is regrettable, and that is one of the sisters was in denial. I'm very much a believer in a book by Teresa Rando called Grief, Dying, and Death. It's published way back in the 70s by the Research Press, but she goes into how there are death-defying cultures, death-accepting cultures, and death-denying cultures. It's very interesting that I think there are death-defying people, death-denying people, and death-accepting people. And my wife's older sister was a death-denying person, and she brought these quacks from Canada to the house who offered for a minimal payment of $15,000 cash, we're going to provide a miracle cure and take her off to some facility, which my wife didn't want and which I didn't want, the family didn't want. And the sister became very, very insistent about this, denying this and so forth, to the point where we had to get a court order restraining the sister from turning up at the house and attempting to take her sister out of the home and hand her over to these quacks. So anyone out there listening, please beware of the con artists and the charlatans who smell the desperation of people who are in denial about the dying process and who want money up front offering miracle cures that basically don't exist except by genuine miracle. Which of course can happen, but I don't think you need to pay cash in advance for them.
As you were going all through these things, what did you learn about taking care of yourself? As you're watching a loved one at the end of his life, but you got to take care of yourself at the same time, too. How did you learn to do that? What did you learn?
Well, I wasn't very good at it, to be honest. And I went through what so many families and bedside caregivers go through, which is caregiver stress and burnout. And if you, what I think any family who's going through this process needs to know is that you cannot do it all on your own. You can't. You need help. You need support. You need your friends. You need as many family members who will do whatever they can for you. And as much as possible, don't say no to somebody who says, I'll go out and do a grocery shop for you, or I'll cook a meal for you. Don't say no to someone who says, look, I'll sit by the bed for a couple of hours while you go out and take a walk, or while you go read a book, perhaps, or do anything else. You've got to give yourself breaks. Most hospice organizations do have a respite clause in the hospice agreement, which allows a 4- and 5-day break from a long process of bedside care, and please do take advantage of those because you'll need the break. You need to get away for a day or two even, or even the 5-day respite. You've got to keep yourself healthy in order to keep caring for the patient, or you'll break down and burn out. And I learned that I had to do this for myself as much as I suppose my defect as a person is I try to be too controlling, and as much as in the end I wanted to control the situation, you've got to let go, and it's a process of letting go. And part of that is to acknowledge that I'm tired, I'm hungry, I haven't slept in 2 nights that were difficult. I need to get away, even briefly, to just recover myself and stay healthy. And so you've got to be very, very mindful of that. It's the time to call on your friends. And even if a family member is repulsed by bedside care and wants nothing to do with that, that family member can sit by the bed and read a poem or read a story or watch the patient's favorite movie with the patient. Whatever they can do, let them do it. And learn how to make your support system work for you in as healthy a way as possible. For you. All too many caregivers in America end up at the end of a long process of a loved one dying, feeling broke, alone, exhausted, and hating their own lives. And you've got to do everything possible to make sure that doesn't happen and guard yourself and guard your own sanity. Because after all, I don't think your loved one would want you to be ruined and wrecked and hating your life at the end of it. Do something that you love to do, that makes you love your own life, even as you're helping your loved one die.
You have said that we need to make dying part of healing the illness. Say a little more about that. How difficult is that for people who shy away, like your sister-in-law did, from dealing with the impending death of a loved one?
Well, I think we're a culture that really has a sort of shadowy relationship to death and dying anyway. I read a recent Pew Research study that said that more than a third of all Americans, even senior citizens, have never made any plans for their own deaths, haven't thought about it. They've turned their backs on it. They're denying it. And I think a lot of family members also sort of deny the reality of it. And yet, when one truly thinks about death and dying, it's as much a part of being human as being born, and we will all go through it. We should make a bigger and better cultural place for it. Terminal illness will end in death, and accepting that is one of the parts of learning how to care for someone who's dying. Then the other part of it is to do what I call kind of healing the dying person. You said it, Dave, mm-hmm. and your friend who said the cancer didn't beat me, I fought in a way I've triumphed in my stand against the cancer trying to kill me. Well, that's one way to look at a kind of healing thought. That's a healing thought because it allows the individual to transcend the disease. In the case of both my, in all three cases I've been through, the aunt in my family, my late first wife, and my brother, whom my dear wife Carola and I did all the care for virtually, it was settling unfinished business, getting the legal affairs in order, coming to some sort of spiritual awareness of the meaning of life, and understanding that in making that transition, the dying person is leaving something very valuable behind, which is, which has been the meaning of his or her life. And that, I think, is a healing moment when that happens. Mm-hmm. And I feel that everything that we can do as family members to make sure that the person who's dying comes to that that place is about healing. There's also, I think, spiritual help is extremely necessary. Even though, you know, my brother was no great religious believer, tough guy and Vietnam veteran that he was. He wasn't a churchgoer. I certainly invited a minister friend in to just say a prayer by the bed, and he seemed to accept that and go with that. Same thing with my late wife, who did have religious beliefs. But as much as one can encourage that sort of religious and spiritual attitude toward dying, I think, even if it's in a secular way, that my life meant something because, and one can look at the concrete contributions and results of a life, is a part of a healing process. And I think it helps the family, too, to heal after the death. To look back and say, yes, this experience meant something. It was meaningful for my loved one, and it's meaningful for all of us.
You urge people to know how they want their end-of-life experience to go. So let me ask you, do you know what you want your end-of-life experience to be like?
Well, I've often joked that I'll rent a boat and just head out into the Pacific and pull the plug and have the obituary read Lost at Sea, which would be a romantic thing for a romantic tag for a writer to have. But realistically speaking, my choices are that for those last 2 weeks, I don't want my wife, Carola, whom I love very much and who I have a very good positive relationship with, to go through all the difficult physical parts of my dying. I am personally going to try to make sure that I'm in a facility, even though it is a hospital, perhaps, or another kind of care facility away from the home. I'll make that choice in order to spare my family members the bedside care or hospice care situation that so many people are choosing. That doesn't mean that other people should do this. It's just going to be my choice because I guess I'm too much of a controlling person to want my wife to change my diapers, to be quite frank about it, because that's what it comes down to in the end, the chucks, the diapers, the bed pads, the basin held for the suffering person, administering the medications, all of that. I would really rather take that away from my loved ones and have them come and visit. I think of a good friend of mine, Chuck Hawk, who died about 3 years ago, and he was a wonderful member of our Las Vegas community, helped a lot of young people out, and he was in the union, I don't know quite which one, I think it was the Iron Workers Union, and worked on power plants, who was dying of mesothelioma. He set himself up in the nursing home over on Harmon and was propped up in the bed, had all the professionals doing things for him. And I can't tell you, there were dozens and dozens of young people he had helped in the community for years who kept coming and visiting in shifts. And he would jazz on and talk and give life advice and very meaningful advice to them all the way to just before the end. And I keep thinking, well, that's kind of the way I would want to go.
That's a pretty good way to go.
That was a pretty good way to go, still helping others, still teaching others, still giving them advice. And at the end, sort of the curtain drawn around the bed and let the professionals do it. But that doesn't mean that the hospice care circumstance can't be a very good one. It can be. And certainly the home nursing care situation with a home care company, not a hospice company, may allow a little bit broader control, provided that your insurance pays for it and you can, you know, manage the finances of doing that. I think that would be my second choice, would be to do it that way over and above hospice care, because I don't want my loved ones doing all that physical body care. I'm a lot like my brother who didn't want me to do that, but we ended up doing it. It was okay in the end, and God bless him, and you know, God bless everyone out there who's going through this experience. And you know, I always I think my favorite saying about death is I didn't even know who had written it, and I always put it, you know, death is a horizon, and a horizon is only a limit to what we can see. And that's not the exact quote. And I didn't even realize Carly Simon had put that in a song called Life is Eternal. But I guess it was a guy named Rossiter Raymond who invented that saying. But I do believe that. I believe that what we're living now is only a part of something else. That something must follow. I'm not sure what it is, and certainly it's like a horizon I can't see over. Or I'd like to take solace in Socrates and what he said in the Apology, that when he's about to be dispatched by the Athenian governors, about to be executed, and he says, well, you know, if there is an afterlife, then I'm going to look forward to it, and you're not doing me any great harm by doing what you're going to do. And if it's the other way around, if there isn't, well, then it's going to be no worse than a very, very deep sleep. And I love to go to sleep.
Douglas Unger is an author and English professor at UNLV. He cared for relatives at the end of their lives, including his wife and his brother. Doug Unger, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dave.